Jews east and west helped to create what was the first truly glorious Jewish structure that towered over Jerusalem since the destruction of the Temple. It was technically known as the Beit Yaakov Synagogue after the father of Baron Rothschild, but because it was built on a site where a synagogue had been destroyed by a mob, it was called the Churva, the destruction. Welcome to Jerusalem 365, episode 143, Churva. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. Towering today over the Jewish quarter of the Old City is the Churva, one of the most beautiful synagogues in the Jewish world. Initially, for such an exquisite edifice, its name, Churva, destruction, might seem strange. But we can appreciate the appellation when we understand that synagogues on that site, where the Churva is today, were destroyed, rebuilt, and destroyed again, only to be once more rebuilt. The history of the synagogue is bound up with the story of Ashkenazic Jews in the city. And, in a certain sense, its story captures the miracle of Jewish Jerusalem itself. We have thus far traced the arrival of Sephardic Jews to the Holy Land and to Jerusalem. Let us now attempt to explore the attempts of Ashkenazic Jews, following the onset of the Ottoman era, to settle in Jerusalem, drawing again primarily on Aaron Horovitz's excellent book about the Old City of Jerusalem, Jerusalem Footsteps Through Time. In 1699, hundreds of Jews, followers of a charismatic and messianically minded man known as Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid, or Rabbi Judah the Pious, journeyed to Jerusalem. Arriving there, they incurred a great deal of debt in order to ensure the presence of a synagogue for themselves. F.E. Peters, in his collection of accounts about Jerusalem, gives us one from a follower of Rabbi Judah, who tells us of Rabbi Judah's arrival, his illness and death soon after, and the pressing debt linked to the synagogue, as well as the difficulty Ashkenazic Jews had in finding any source of livelihood in the city. He writes of the language barrier, given that local Arabs spoke, as he puts it, quote-unquote, Aramaic, by which he meant Arabic. He further noted how this created a difference between the Ashkenazic community and their Sephardic brethren, who spoke Arabic and Turkish. He also tells us that when they followed Rabbi Judah in Europe, they had been promised a great deal of support, but that support had never arrived. This follower of Rabbi Judah writes as follows, quote, "But let us return to our great worries, which the synagogue building brought about. Our debt pressed like a heavy yoke on our necks. We are continually taken into custody, and before one debtor can be redeemed, another has already been detained. One scarcely dares go out in the street, where, to cap it all, the tax collectors lie in wait like wolves and lions to devour us. When we journeyed with our master to Jerusalem, we passed through the whole of Germany and were promised everywhere that we would receive regular support. At that time, we believed we could maintain ourselves in worthy fashion. But now we are oppressed with debts, and we have to give money meant for our sustenance to the Turks so that they should not fling us into prison, for prison is the worst of all. It is hard for us Ashkenazis to begin to trade here, since we lack knowledge of the language. The Sephardic Jews talk Ladino, the Arabs talk Aramaic, and the Turks Turkish. None of them understand German," end quote. Let us now pick up the story, drawing on Horovitz's account. In response to the Jewish failure to pay their debts, a mob attacked the synagogue in 1720, burning it to the ground, along with the 40 Torah scrolls that were inside. And from this point on, for many decades, Ashkenazic Jews were banned by authorities from Jerusalem, so that when Ashkenazim wished to enter the sacred city, they would put on the garb of local Sephardic Jewry in order to attain access. It was only around 100 years later that Ashkenazim openly returned to Jerusalem. These were followers of the Rabbi Elijah of Vilna, or the Vilna Gaon, known as Purushim, motivated by Rabbi Elijah's vision of Itaruta Dilatata, the mystical concept of an awakening from below, and a belief similar to that of Ramban, expressed many centuries before, that redemption for Jerusalem would only come when Jews acted on behalf of Jerusalem and the land of Israel. The Purushim settled in Safed, but after a pandemic there in 1816, one of their leaders, Rabbi Menachem Mendel of Shklov, began to negotiate with Muslim authorities for the right to return to Jerusalem and to build a house of worship there. This was only achieved 20 years later in 1836. We will tell the larger story when we turn at length to the 19th century. But for now, I will just quote the National Library of Israel's Zach Rothbart, who wrote in the Jerusalem Post that, quote, "It took about 5 years, but after sending representatives all the way to Istanbul to negotiate with the Ottoman authorities, Rabbi Menachem Mendel's men succeeded in securing a royal decree annulling the debts owned by the previous unrelated Ashkenazi community decades earlier. They then successfully focused their efforts on securing additional documents from local and international Islamic and civil authorities that would ultimately allow them to develop the compound, which had been abandoned by the previous Ashkenazi community and destroyed by its creditors. End quote. First, a smaller edifice was constructed, known as Menachem Tzion. But then, another disaster in Safed, an earthquake, brought more Ashkenazim to Jerusalem, and they decided to create a more spacious structure. The site they selected was the one at which the mob destroyed the synagogue 100 years before. The point is profound. Where the brethren had prayed, they would pray. Where the Torah scrolls had been incinerated, new Torah scrolls would be read. Where a synagogue had stood and then been reduced to rubble by haters of Jews, a new Beit Knesset would rise. A new synagogue would come into being. And what a synagogue it was. One of the most exquisite in the Jewish world, with a marble floor and a dome adorned with designs that imitated the starry sky. Much of the funds for it came from Baron Alphonse de Rothschild, but support also came from one Sephardic family, that of Yechezkel ben Reuben of Baghdad. We must ponder how two philanthropists of Western Europe and Iraq came together to support the creation of this sanctuary. I remember Rabbi Jonathan Sacks describing then Prime Minister Tony Blair asking him why there were so many verses in what Blair called, quote-unquote, the boring bit of the Bible, by which he meant the lengthy discussion of the tabernacle. Rabbi Sacks joked, reflecting on it, saying something like, God created the universe in 34 verses, but one synagogue in the desert takes up 600 verses, and he quipped that this was because synagogues are built by committees. But the truth is, as he later explained, so many verses in Exodus is devoted to the tabernacle because its creation embodied the diversity of the Jewish people coming together in unity, with each Israelite giving to the tabernacle what they had in terms of treasure or talent. Here too, in this synagogue, Jews east and west helped to create what was the first truly glorious Jewish structure that towered over Jerusalem since the destruction of the temple. It was technically known as the Beit Yaakov Synagogue after the father of Baron Rothschild, but because it was built on a site where a synagogue had been destroyed by a mob, it was called the Churva, the destruction. The name embodies all that Nachmanides believed and all that Judah Halevi held dear. Even if it was destroyed, it was still beloved, and this love would drive its rebuilding. Or, to paraphrase the Kuzari of Judah Halevi, Jerusalem would be rebuilt when, as Halevi wrote, Israel yearns for it to such an extent that they embrace her stones and dust. There is a certain foreboding here, for what was once a churva, once destroyed, could be destroyed again, as indeed it was, dynamited by the Jordanian legions in 1948. The leader of the Jordanian legion proudly proclaimed that, quote, for the first time in 1,000 years, not a single Jew remains in the Jewish quarter. Not a single building remains intact. This, he said, makes the Jews' return here impossible, end quote. One author who grew up in the 1940s in the Jewish quarter, Pua Steiner, returned in 1967 with her husband Chaim and with thousands of other Jews to the Old City and discovered the ruins of her beloved synagogue. She writes, quote, we are inside the Churva, Chaim announced, beaming with joy. But I collapsed on the stairway, too stunned to speak. I looked all around me but could find no sign of the magnificent synagogue of my childhood. And then a bit later she adds, I gazed at the stump of the shattered bima, the marble bima, and hid my face in my hands. This then was indeed the Churva. This was all that was left of that grand synagogue, the magnificent holy ark, the decorated walls, the stained glass windows, the star-shaped dome, the chandeliers, all in ruins. End quote. And there, in a redeemed, joyous Jerusalem, Pua Steiner wept, mourning for the sanctuary of her childhood. And then she writes, slowly, I stood up and went over to kiss the marble stones of the bima. Then we made our way towards the Kotel. End quote. There she prayed for the rebuilding of the Churva and the other ruins of Jerusalem. When it comes to the Churva, her prayers have been completely fulfilled, for now it stands almost exactly as it was. The Churva, the embodiment of the regeneration of the Ashkenazic community in Jerusalem, will appear several times in the story that we will tell in our episodes of Jerusalem 365. We will see it welcome interesting visitors and worshipers, including William Seward and Sir Herbert Samuel, not to mention rabbis who prayed there often, such as Rabbi Avraham Yitzchak Cook. But as I have argued in commentary, the story that begins in the early 18th century, the story of the Churva, is also so significant because Jewish Jerusalem, through the ages, is akin to the Churva, the name and the sanctuary. It constantly rises from the ruins, thereby embodying a Jewish people that phoenix-like refuses to die. The Churva, which first embodied the return of a Jewish community, today, along with the other sacred sanctuaries of the Holy City embody the return of Jewish Jerusalem and the return of a people to its beloved city. This is Mayor Soloveitchik, looking forward to learning together tomorrow. Signing off.